Welcome to My Kind of Weird, a podcast where two people sit down and pitch three kinds of media: something watchable, something readable, and something listenable, to see if at the end of the pod each person says, "That's my kind of weird." I'm your host, Anthony Pollock, and joining us on the podcast today is comic book writer Gary Proudley from Wurundjeri Land, also known as Melbourne, Australia. Gary Proudley's webcomic is a Viking-themed anthology called Talgard, featuring a Viking warrior and his many adventures. Talgard is out at the moment through Just Out Publishing. Gary, are you ready to get weird with me today?
I am indeed.
So, Gary, please present your something watchable.
Okay, so my something watchable is a Canadian TV show called Letterkenny.
There's something real pervy about that word, taste.
How are the first few bites tasting?
Everything tasting to your liking?
I see you've had a taste.
Oh, yeah, you like how it tastes?
Check, please.
Which one of you beat the shit out of my cousin?
Happy me.
That's how they do it in Canada, then, eh?
Now, Letterkenny has only been watchable reasonably recently in Australia. It's a show that I'd found links on YouTube. Friends have sent me links to bits. I've got a friend who lives in Canada. But unfortunately, it was one of those media that you had to pirate if you wanted to watch in Australia, and I wasn't willing to do that. So I had to wait until it came out on iTunes in the last 6 to 12 months before I could actually watch it. So Letterkenny is... The closest I could sort of way I could describe it is by saying it's the Trailer Park Boys meets Kevin Smith.
It definitely has that feel to it, especially given Kevin Smith's sort of penchant for Canadian humour. So, yeah, I can very much see that for sure.
Yeah, it's about a small town in Canada of 5,000 people called Letterkenny, and it's just about the lives of the various groups of people that live in that city. There's the skids, which are basically meth heads, the hockey players,
yep,
and the farmers.
So I guess what I really dug about this when I checked it out, like I thought I had heard of this show before, but when I actually checked it out, it's actually the exact opposite of what I thought it was. For some reason, I thought Letterkenny was a animated comedy. I don't know why I thought that, but I love the dry wit and humor in it, and I just love the sort of the monotone that the main two characters sort of just throw at those that, I guess, really despise their way of life, which is kind of comforting in its own sort of perverse way. So, unfortunately, I wasn't able to see all of it because, yeah, it's hard to get in Australia, but I liked what I saw.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of elements. Like, it's a show that's a lot deeper than it appears on the surface. The initial thing that sort of attracted me to it is people who live in the city tend to have a disdain for people who live in the country.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed sort of, I guess you could almost call it the juxtaposition of this really sort of urbane dialogue coming from hick accents, somebody wearing plaid, but sort of really fast-paced dialogue that belies the underlying sort of intelligence of the people, of the characters.
Mm. Hmm. And, I mean, I just there's that juxtaposition, but there's also the juxtaposition of they saw the hicks they're actually quite intelligent in terms of their quips that they throw at people that they don't like or they don't like them.
Yeah, they are. I mean, I would have to say that they're not mean-spirited necessarily. They're certainly sort of a bit like that. I don't know if it was like you, but when I was in high school with my friends, we would insult each other, but it was never mean-spirited. And if someone outside of our friend groups insulted one of us, that would be a very different kettle of fish. It's a really great show for subtly breaking down masculinity, toxic and otherwise, and sort of some of the ways that we interact with each other is by these sort of insulting quips.
Yeah.
sort of as the show progresses, Squirrely Dan, which is the larger gentleman with the beard, often brings up his women's studies class. So whenever they're discussing sort of any hot topic or just, you know, anybody that's not straight white male, it's often put in context by Squirrely Dan's women's studies professor, which I think is wonderful to see this sort of, you know, enormous bearded fat guy, which, you know, it's very easy to see myself in that, wearing overalls, not so easy to see myself in that bit, but discussing homophobia in this sort of rural setting and how it applies to them and how it maybe wouldn't be acceptable to use homosexual people to lure in degenerates that have been bothering them so they could beat them up, and, you know, how using people as bait is homophobic, and explaining that to the other hicks, you know, it by recontextualizing all of this stuff, it makes me step back and sort of reassess my own views on these things.
So, yeah, that's it's I feel like it's something that needs to be discovered for sure. And when the bits that I've watched of it, it just kind of makes me wonder, like, how have I not heard of this already, and how have I not watched it already? But obviously, I just feel like it's one of those shows that has the potential, like, once it's a bit more accessible over here in Australia, that will definitely explode. I can the funny thing is about shows like this, I find it's the people that are being directly targeted in the narrative are the ones that will actually enjoy it in droves, but they won't conceive the context behind it and why that's targeting, well, not really targeting them as such, but it's addressing the issues that people make, that, you know, homophobia isn't okay, toxic masculinity is not okay, and all those sorts of things. So but then that just goes to further emphasize just how brilliant the writing is. Do you know who wrote the show?
I'm not 100% sure. I believe the main character, the guy who plays Wayne, Jared Keyser, I think he wrote or created a lot of it, but
okay, yeah,
he was one of the creators of the show. Yep. I'm not sure how many episodes he wrote or what the breakdown of that is.
Now, my Something Watchable is a little cartoon that came out in the 1990s called Gargoyles by Disney.
1,000 years ago, superstition and the sword ruled. It was a time of darkness. It was a world of fear. It was the age of gargoyles. Stone by day, warriors by night. We were betrayed by the humans we had sworn to protect, frozen in stone by a magic spell for 1,000 years.
Yes. I will kind of go to my grave saying the most successful cartoon is this show. And the reason for that is here we have sort of these misfits that are presented to the modern world who are from basically out of time. And I guess it goes into them wanting to be accepted and failing to sort of understand the, I guess, sometimes the ramifications of the actions that they're making. At the same time, it provides a really good narrative on sort of the views that sort of mainstream humanity has on anyone that is different. But at the same time, it's a cartoon. It's really deep. It's quite serious in nature. There are, of course, sort of funnier elements to it. But I would say it's the most successful cartoon that Disney have ever produced. And it's one of those cartoons as well that you just go to yourself, really? Disney did this? I just don't believe it.
Yeah, I'll admit, so I was passingly familiar with this cartoon. I vaguely recall it being a cartoon on in the mornings when I was maybe 14 or 15. And I think it was the cartoon that came on at the time that I had to leave for school.
Okay.
So I believe I've seen an awful lot of half episodes of Gargoyles. I don't have strong abiding memories of it because I never saw a resolution to any story.
Yeah.
So in preparation for the podcast, I went back and started rewatching it. Now I watched half of the first season, but I only saw two stories. So what you say about, wow, did Disney actually make this, really applies here, because the first five episodes are one story.
Yes. Yeah, and if you, as you get further into the show, eventually it starts with the whole Goliath doing the whole the 1,000 years ago, that introduction doesn't actually kick off until the first, until the gargoyles actually end up in modern day America, and after, you know, Xanatos is revealed as the bad guy. So it kind of, it's for a kid's show, it kind of had that plan to never give any sort of spoilers away in terms of what this thing is actually about, which I find quite impressive. I find it quite impressive that this show was greenlit by Disney of all places, you know? So,
I mean, that would be reasonably impressive for a kid's show now, let alone in the mid-90s.
Yeah, and it's an original property.
Yeah, it was a very complicated sort of, I mean, there were betrayals after betrayals after betrayals in that first sort of five episodes.
Yeah.
If I had one criticism for it, it would be, as an Australian, I cringe deeply whenever I hear Americans doing Australian accents. Because maybe one out of 20 gets it right, maybe. So I can't possibly imagine what it feels like to be a Scottish person and hear Americans just do awful, awful approximations of a Scottish accent.
Yes.
Because it doesn't sound right to my ear.
It doesn't sound right. You are correct there. I guess it's kind of reminds me of the I don't know if you ever watched the X-Men cartoon, but whenever they had a Aussie character on there, the accent sounded more like a sort of a British tourist than it sounded like an Australian. So
it was Pyro,
it was Pyro, correct.
Vaguely like Cockney sounding.
Yes, very much so.
Which there's a small part of the back of my brain that says that I think Cockney sounding would have been the Australian accent for the first 40 or 50 years of Australia existing as a European colonized country. I'm sure I read that somewhere. So
yeah,
I can see where they'd get there, but it's not like it's that hard to do a little research on that, what an Australian accent sounds like.
So to close out my pitch on this is I'm just going to go through the voice cast alone. So Keith David, who, if people aren't familiar with Keith David by name, he's pretty much been the main sort of African-American who tends to turn up in early John Carpenter films. If you're a horror fan like myself, then you've probably seen The Thing to death. He's the gentleman who ends up surviving, besides the main character. There's that person alone. There's Ed Asner is a voice character in there. If you're a Star Trek fan, for some reason they decided that Star Trek actors would make great bad guys in this show, which is very strange. So, for instance, the one that plays Xanatos is Jonathan Frakes, who played Commander Will Riker in Star Trek The Next Generation. And his love interest, played by Marina Sirtis in that very show, plays Demona. So it's, that's a bit odd. But and then there's quite a few other well-known voice actors that end up on this show at some point as well. Definitely a lot of Star Trek actors that play bad guys, which is an interesting decision to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible cast.
So, Gary, present your something readable.
Okay, so my something readable is a, oh, it's probably a 30, 35-year-old single issue of Fantastic Four. Yes. It is written and drawn by Walt Simonson.
Yeah.
And it is an incredible sort of showcase of the medium of comics. So,
right, yep.
Essentially, now it's a very complicated comic to read. Can I ask, did you manage to get a hold of it?
I did. I got a hold of it, thank Christ, for Comixology. I don't know how else I would have got it.
Right.
Not paid through the butt for it.
No.
So, yes, yes, definitely read it in preparation for this podcast.
Right. So, now, the Comixology version of it, because this is what Comixology does, they, of course, cut out the letter pages. Now, there was a key in the letter page of that issue explaining how to read the comic. Did you figure it out without that key? It was difficult.
I guess that depends on what the answer is. Hey,
yeah, fair enough.
Okay. But I mean, I was able to follow in terms of, the various different jumping points and all that type of stuff. And
I'll just explain for people what happens. So each page of the comic, or the first, 18-odd pages of the comic, is separated out into two columns. The first column runs through natural time, and the second column is a battle through time for Reed Richards and Doctor Doom. So
basically it's Fantastic Four semicolon Tenant.
Yeah, basically. it's very, very much like that. But what I especially love about this story is, so, you know, you read the normal column and it's a fairly pedestrian story. It's just a normal superhero fare. There's nothing unusual about it.
Yeah.
But with the Reed and Doom story, they jump around in time. And each time at the end of the page is an indication of where they've gone in time. So you jump backward and forward in the book, page to page, to find where they've gone in the normal linear story, to find the story as it plays out for those two characters. Now, what this does is that moves you about physically in space, which changes time. And it really, as a book, almost did as much for me as a writer to understand how the movement of time is actually the movement of space in a comic book than anything except for, say, understanding comics by Scott McCloud.
Right, yeah.
It's only really a thing that you can do in comics. You couldn't do it in many other great medium. Maybe a choose-your-own-adventure book, but I'm not sure it would work as well, because as the two parallel stories happen, occasionally they interact. So Johnny, Ben, and Sue interact with Reed and Doom throughout their story, but they're doing it in a way that's sort of out of sync.
Yeah, they're kind of doing it in a way that's almost observational. They're kind of seeing an event occur, but they're very much sort of like the almost like the audience surrogate for this issue, because they don't know what's going on as much as the reader doesn't know what's going on, at least for the first read.
That's exactly right.
So for me, there's a couple of things in this I feel that I'm going to address. So now when did this come out? It wasn't in the 70s?
No. This is 80s. Maybe early 90s or late 80s.
Early 90s, yeah. I feel my own kind of prejudice against the Fantastic Four is making me not enjoy this book as much as other people would. I didn't start liking the Fantastic Four until their son was actually introduced in the sort of the mid-90s. So, and I kind of felt their son having mutant powers gave a bit of an extra dynamic to the whole Fantastic Four shtick. But for me, I've never really liked this sort of the pretentiousness of how Reed Richards is written, that he's a lot more highly intelligent than the reader themselves. And I feel like that's kind of the the reason why certain people won't read a Fantastic Four book or won't continue to read a Fantastic Four book. I've never liked the kind of the trailing speak that links to each page and each panel that Reed Richards has to explain exactly what he's doing, because a lot of the time it's too much sci-fi gobbledygook. That's just too much for me personally. And the other problem as well is I spend more time emphasizing and sympathizing with Dr. Doom than I do Reed Richards. So I don't know if that's just me and my problem, but that's what I find that happens whenever I read a Fantastic Four book.
I don't think that's wrong. I mean, that Doom's basically set up as a fifth member, as far as, you know, the book is concerned. Look, yeah. The criticism with Reed is it's a valid one. The sort of very verbose style of Reed, though, it's hard to pull off. Like, so Stan Lee did it really well back in the day, but Stan Lee's style of writing comics doesn't work as well today. Walt Simonson wrote Reed was basically, it felt a lot like Stan writing Reed.
Yeah,
where he does just do long-winded expositional and not even like story expositional dialogue, just Reed talks a lot.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a character trait. And if that puts you off the book, I can understand why you don't like it. That's always sort of been secondary for me. Like, Fantastic Four is sci-fi.
Oh, yeah.
100%. And I love that. And Fantastic Four is a book about families primarily, and not every writer got that or put that front and center. And I think that sells the book short a little bit more than Reed being hard to relate to.
Yeah, there's that, and this issue specifically reads more like a Flash and Reverse Flash trope with Reed Richards and Dr. Doom sort of etched on top of one another. It felt very much like a Flash comic.
Because the whole 110%.
Disappearing and the disappearing and reappearing stuff. But I can see where you come from in terms of understanding the difference between time and space and how certain causality in events can affect other causality in events later on, and how there can be sort of like a cause and effect that can go forward as well as backwards. So it's a great sort of masterclass in that respect. It doesn't change the fact, though, I think I'm just a Reed Richards hater. I think that's my problem, Gary.
I have no problem with that. I'm not here as much even to sell the characters, although I do love to do that because I'm quite an FF fan. But just this specific issue, I really love what Simonson does in sort of making the implicit that I knew that space was time in a comic book. You know, each space that a panel takes up is a moment in time or a short period of time, and sort of plays with that a lot more in the form of comics.
Good pitch. Now, my pitch is for something readable, that is Grit Issue 1, which came out last year from Brian Wickman and Kevin Castaniero. Hope I haven't butchered that surname. And it was published by Scout Comics. Now, did you get to have a bit of a look at this one?
I absolutely did, yes.
Okay. So I'll present my pitch. Now, it's basically about this sort of old sort of journeyman slash farmer slash we get sort of the, I guess, idea that he may have been a warrior at some point, and sort of he finds himself in the company of a wannabe doomsday cult, which wants to bring about the resurrection of some sort of giant beast, whether it's a demon or what have you, although we find out in later issues, spoilers, that this series is very demon sort of, they're the main antagonists. Now, he always carries an axe around, whether that's chopping wood or what have you, and towards the end of this sort of issue, he kind of is a bit like a Ash from like Evil Dead character, except inserted into sort of a fantasy setting. The artwork is sort of drawn in a way that's very rough in style, which kind of works to the effect of the sort of the gore, because it doesn't feel like gore in certain panels. It feels like just kind of this celebration of warriors versus monsters, and it's sort of if you've seen The Witcher or played the game, I feel like it's a comic book that you'll really gravitate towards and really enjoy, and you'll certainly pick up the other two issues that have been released so far. Now, what did you think about it?
I was not as sort of gung-ho on it. I think I sort of had a look, and there was like, I think 11 pages that were just fight scenes with basically no dialogue beyond expletives. And it didn't seem much to be progressing the plot. So it seemed to be a bit gratuitous.
Okay.
Which I don't necessarily have a problem with, but I think this just went just that tiny bit too far on the wrong side of the seesaw for me. Like, I read this not too long after reading Headlopper, which has got a lot of gratuitous sort of action scenes in it. But Headlopper didn't seem to go over, whereas this one did a little bit.
Okay.
What isn't sort of filled in with action scenes is intriguing in terms of world building.
Okay.
I don't know whether or not they'll pay off on that. It's a bit like watching the first episode of Lost. Like, there was so much going on there, it makes me intrigued to have a look at some more. But I can't say whether or not it's good until I read more of it and find out whether the payoff's there or not.
Yeah.
Now, the gratuitous violence thing, that's like, I'm very willing to admit that's just a personal preference.
Yeah.
I'd prefer violence if it progresses the plot or reveals character.
Yeah.
And after about 5 pages, I think we've got the character.
See, I feel like there's something almost comforting about a comic book that is willing to be hand over fist, admitting that this is a guy that's just going to kick monsters' asses, and that's pretty much what it's going to be. It's not trying to be something. It's not trying to sort of kind of put forth a message or a narrative that is, so outlandish beyond, I guess, the station of the world it's built in. I just feel like sometimes people, creators who create, I guess, monster stories about war and all those types of things, sometimes they need to own the world that they're creating and understand that sometimes it's just a monster story. I mean, other times it might be a monster story with some humanism to it, but sometimes it's just a monster story, you know?
Yeah. I think that's absolutely a valid way of looking at it, and I can see people enjoying it for that reason. I wouldn't say it lost me, but I did find myself sort of waiting for the fight scenes to end.
Mm. All right, Gary, present your something listenable.
Oh, okay. So my something listenable is Postmodern Jukebox. Actually, bear with me one moment. I always forget the person's name because it's not just Postmodern Jukebox. It's
Jason, wasn't it? Jason.
Scott Bradley. Apologies to Scott Bradley that I forgot his name.
So definitely not Jason.
No, definitely not Jason. So Scott Bradley's Postmodern Jukebox is not so much a brand as it is like an umbrella it's a band where the singers, the musicians all rotate in and out. They do cover songs of mostly reasonably modern songs, but they recontextualize them into sometimes even sort of slightly other different variations on those themes of jazz versions.
I got a bit of lounge influences as well, if we're going to throw another genre in there.
Yeah, there's certainly some of that in there. There's gospel music occasionally. Like they don't stick necessarily to one style, but they have that sort of those few styles that they work in and recontextualize songs in.
Now, you sent that to me to listen to, but I actually found myself going to YouTube to see if they actually had any videos. And, I mean, I feel like to actually appreciate this project, if you want to call it that, as a whole, is to actually look at the videos and watch them. And it's actually nothing shy of impressive, that's for sure.
Yeah.
For instance, you mentioned the swapping in and out of band members in different roles and things like that. I think the video of this project that I saw that most impressed me was when they tackled the Friends theme. The different sort of singers that jumped on for different bits, and what the song kind of does is it starts at 1920s, but as it progresses in the chorus and the different verses, it actually moves thematically through the different styles of the decades that follow. So that was interesting. But then at the same time, there was a really impressive video of this project where there's a piano rendition of Black Hole Sun by Soundgarden, which sounded a lot better than the original song, which is really hard to achieve. So, yeah.
Yeah, I know exactly the one you mean. You're right, the visuals are amazing. There was a while there where Postmodern Jukebox came out to Australia and found themselves in Brisbane lining up with the same weekend as Supernova Brisbane. This happened like 4 or 5 years in a row. So myself and a few other comics people had like almost a tradition of going and watching Postmodern Jukebox perform in Brisbane. And, yeah, they're a band that's as important to watch visually as it is to listen to. They're incredible. They usually bring out somebody like a tap dancer or something as well for on stage.
And they're just so perfectly named as well.
Mm.
I mean, it really is a postmodern jukebox. It's basically a jukebox of songs put through a different lens of different styles. So it's aptly named.
I find them really useful for putting on in the background music while I'm working because they're not distracting, but they are enjoyable.
Right. Yeah. Got you. Now, my something listenable is the Assassin's Creed Valhalla soundtrack. Now, we haven't really spoken about any games on this podcast so far, but we'll do something a little bit different with this pitch. I wanted to get what your thoughts were initially of it.
I absolutely loved it. The sort of video game music is incredible for that sort of atmospheric feel where you can just sort of lose yourself in it a little bit. And it works really well with the sort of choral that not every piece in the Assassin's Creed music was choral, but quite a lot of them were. It reminded me of another one of my favorite video game soundtracks, which is Rome Total War. A lot of sort of choral elements to the music in it. I don't know how period accurate it is, but it certainly felt to me, you know, being mostly ignorant, it felt great. It felt period accurate.
So have you seen the Viking show?
Only a few episodes.
Okay. So Assassin's Creed Valhalla, now you don't really need to know we're not really going to go into what the game is about because you need a whole podcast series to even cover half of that. So the soundtrack itself is, well, it's a It's basically about Vikings invading England around, I believe it's around 12th, 13th or 14th century England. Now, the soundtrack itself is by composer Sarah Schachner and Jesper Kidd and Norwegian composer Ina Selvik. Now, Selvik is responsible for the music behind the Vikings TV show. So it's very, and what I've often taken from that music, it's very sort of paganistic. It's very sort of, there's lots of indigenous sort of Viking sort of soundscapes, and it's very atmospheric in that regard. I guess it's very period specific, the sounds of it. The really great thing about that as well is that if you're a metalhead, then Ina Selvik is a Norwegian musician who used to be the drummer for a black metal band called Gorgoroth. So, and he's also the lead singer in a metal band called Wardruna. So it kind of, what I feel that I like about this soundtrack is it's by Europeans who are delving into their sort of their ancestry as the core influences that end up stylistically on the soundtrack itself. So that's basically my pitch. You don't really need to sort of play the game. You don't need to play Assassin's Creed Valhalla. But if you want to hear something different, if you want to hear sort of sounds that are more, I guess, you know, very sort of European and influenced by the bygone eras of pagans, then it's a great soundtrack to listen to.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was an excellent choice.
So we're going to get straight into what we thought about each other's pitches.
So, Anthony, is Letterkenny your kind of weird?
Yeah, I really think it is. It's, I mean, I feel like it's the right type of sort of narrative meets sort of humor meets just sort of, I guess, explanation on the way that we see different sort of, I guess, problems in society. But it's, I mean, it had me in stitches, so it's definitely my kind of weird.
Excellent.
Now, Gary, in terms of gargoyles, is that your kind of weird?
Definitely. I'd say it's very, very hard to be nostalgic for something that you weren't particularly into at the time, but Gargoyles seems to manage that. The episodes that I saw were great. You know, they say that the golden age of comics is 12. The same thing is probably true of animated TV shows, and Gargoyles is very much a golden age animated TV show as far as I'm concerned. Definitely enjoyed it.
Perfect. Do you have something to ask me about something readable?
So tell me, Anthony, did you find that issue of Fantastic Four, 352, was your kind of weird?
I'm sort of on the fence about it. I'm going to say yes. In turn, but only because of your pitch. If I was just going to look at the comic book as it sits, I would say no. But your pitch was pretty convincing in the way that it's very a good example of, I guess, what can be achieved from a comic book writer's end. And, I mean, I haven't really studied comic books at university or anything or in school, but I feel like this would be a good example of sort of comic book Americana. So, yes, this is my kind of weird. So, Gary, is Grit issue 1 your kind of weird?
I'm going to do a cop-out answer to that and say I'll let you know when I've read Grit issue 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 because it all depends on whether or not they pay off on this world building that they're doing. Just as a single unit, what it was, probably not. But there was enough there to make me wonder whether they're going to pay off on it.
So I think I'll leave you with saying that issue 3 turns it into a rather charming storyline, but I'll let you be the judge of that.
Okay.
So on to something listenable.
Okay, so tell me, Anthony, did you find that Scott Bradley's postmodern jukebox was your kind of weird?
I really do. I kind of, you know, when I hear this, I kind of just want to grab my wife's hand and head straight to the dance floor. It just kind of has that kind of vibe. I'm actually curious as to what the sort of the mosh pit does when they watch this sort of this band perform live, or whether it's a sit down experience or whether it's people actually get up into the pit, so to speak. But yeah, definitely my kind of weird.
Excellent.
And to finish us up, Gary, is the Assassin's Creed Valhalla original soundtrack your kind of weird?
Absolutely. 110%. I enjoyed that immensely. I thought it was really well done. It was thought-provoking, and as I said, I wondered how sort of genuine it is. Hearing what you had to say about who composed it, it makes me think that it's far more likely to be genuine, but whether it is or isn't, it's absolutely enjoyable music.
Excellent. So, and I feel like it'd be a great little listening piece for Talgard as well.
That's a really good point. It would pair very well.
Speaking of Talgard, we're going to go on a quick sponsor break, and when we come back, I'm going to have a quick discussion and interview with Gary about his webcomic series, Talgard.
Hello again, everyone. Producer Andy here once more. The last few times I've asked you to visit sodaandtelepaths.com, the sister website to this very podcast, where you can read all about the latest on comics, science fiction, and horror. I mean, I couldn't have been nicer about it. I patiently explained that at sodaandtelepaths.com you can read all the site's interviews with people in the entertainment industry, along with movie and comic reviews and opinion pieces. But you didn't go. Why not? What do you people want? Tell me. I mean, are you too good for us? Is that it? Oh, what do you want, oh worthy listeners? Huh? Fucking unicorns? Huh? Okay. Fine. There you go. See? Are you happy now? Fine. There you go. Fucking unicorn. Great big unicorn with two horns riding a skateboard through Megan Fox's bathroom. You happy? SodaandTelepaths.com. Go there now, or the unicorn dies. All right.
So, Gary, you've been creating Talgard now for, I'm going to say, what, 2 years? Is that right, or has it been longer?
I think it's probably closer to 3 since I first started working on it, but that's just because it takes a while for these things to take off.
Okay, right. And so that the listeners can sort of understand you and what Talgard is about, give us a bit of an idea of prior to Talgard what you were doing in the creative world.
Okay, so I have a bit of a history as an editor at Gestalt Publishing.
Yep.
So for many years I've been doing conventions with Gestalt Publishing.
Yep.
And wherever you are, you always get people coming up to you with their ideas for their enormous epic story that they'd like to tell in comic book form. And I appreciate and I applaud the passion that goes with wanting to tell a 500-page epic. But
reality is
one, there's no sort of financial way you can make a 500-page epic from an unknown writer work. And most people, when they're starting out in comics, are making a lot of mistakes. And you're much, much, much better off making a mistake in a short story and learning from that than you are getting 150 pages into your 500-page epic and realizing that you've made a mistake in simple things like story structure and then trying to decide whether you're going to fix it or scrap it or what you're going to do. That's burnout. People get burnout from that.
Yeah.
So I found myself convention after convention telling people to do short stories
Yep.
Usually I'd recommend doing an 8-page short story, but, you know, you can do a story in 4 pages. You have your act one, your setup on page one. Page two and three are the progression towards the resolution, act two. And then you turn a page and get to page four and you get your reveal, your turn page reveal and your resolution on page four. Sort of, it's very easy to have a story structure on a 4-page comic. And I spent so long giving people that advice, I eventually thought, well, maybe I should take that advice myself and do it and do it again and again. And that's what Talgard is. It's I've heard it described as flash fiction.
But, I guess that has some substance to it, that opinion.
I mean, that sort of puts it in the context that people can understand.
Yeah.
But they're 4-page short stories all about Talgard, who is, if Conan the Barbarian was the smartest man in the room, then you would have Talgard.
I'd kind of be a bit frightened if Conan was the smartest man in the room. It doesn't really say much about the people in the room, does it?
It doesn't. If he was always the smartest man in the room,
okay, good save.
Yeah.
So why a Viking? I mean, you have a plethora of stuff you could pull from influences wise. Why a Viking?
Well, so sword and sorcery is wonderful because the first point is everybody understands sword and sorcery. If you plonk somebody down in the middle of Game of Thrones or Conan the Barbarian or any of those sort of feels for a world, people know what's happening, and you need to be able to hit the ground running on a 4-page story. You don't have enough time to set up the world and explain to everyone what's going on in 4 pages. You need everyone to understand. So that's one reason why. Two, it's a setting that affords you any kind of storytelling you want. If you want to do a really human story that's about nothing but people and their interactions, you can completely and utterly do that in this world. And if you want to tell a fantastical story that involves magic and otherworldly things, you can also do that in this world. It's very versatile.
Well, on that end, what sort of influences directly do you have around fantasy, around magical storytelling, around warriors, and I guess even sort of on the medieval standpoint, where do you sort of, what's your go-to around those genres?
My biggest influence, and this might seem a little unusual, is Terry Pratchett, which are you familiar with?
Like his Discworld series, or?
Yes, absolutely. So that's a world where everything is magical, but also deeply human and real. The characters that he creates created, since he's passed away now, were, first and foremost, they were people.
Yeah.
So even if they were powerful wizards or witches or whatever they may be, before they were that, they were people. And I'll never be as funny as Terry Pratchett, but I can take away that from him, which is that if you don't have that basis of a character that's a person, nobody's going to care about the fact that they can magic a mountain away.
Now, going to your time with Gestalt Publishing, and Wolfgang's going to kick me in the ass for pronouncing it wrong up until now. What have you done with Gestalt Publishing, like in terms of stories that you've sort of edited with them?
So primarily I was Wolfgang's sort of assistant editor. So I did assistant editorial work on The Deep, for example.
Yeah.
I also did some assistant editorial work on Justin Randall's Changing Ways.
Yeah.
I'm not on every book have I got credits, because sometimes the amount of input that I did was not sufficient to warrant a credit.
Yeah.
But the Stults are very small sort of companies, so everybody's got their fingers in every pie.
Yeah.
As it were.
So
we all must wear many hats.
From how does your, what you've learnt from editing until now, how does that, I guess, impact the way that you approach your own storytelling?
Oh, lots of different things in lots of different ways. My first day at Gestalt, I was an intern, and I was given two scripts. One was not very good. It was just an unsolicited submission. Mm. And the other one was the first issue of The Deep. So that was a test that Wolfgang gave me. He gave me two scripts and said, read both of these and tell me what you think. And I gave him some notes on the not very good one. Mm. And I gave him the other one and said, I think you should publish this. This is really good. Now, as it turns out, they were already, you know, deep into production already at that point. Yeah. Obviously, Wolfgang knew that it was a really good script.
Yeah.
But this was before Tom Taylor was Tom Taylor as he is now, famous.
Yeah.
So I would say that what I learned was, one, seeing some of the best at work like that.
Yeah.
That teaches you so much. I also learned how to be able to break down a story that was pitched to us, see why it wasn't working. Mm. Quite often you do learn by seeing what's not working more than you do learn by seeing what is working. Mm. Any sort of novel, comic that you read published by a publisher is a certain level of quality. Reading some stories that are not that level of quality can be helpful in teaching you where the pitfalls are in writing. Which would,
contrast, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Like, so I would recommend to anyone who's thinking of getting into writing to share scripts with your friends who are at a similar level than you are and try and see where they went wrong. It's a lot easier to see where someone else went wrong than it is to see where you went wrong yourself.
Well, you're just kind of robbing yourself out of potential payday there, Gary. You should have said hire an editor like me.
Yeah. If you can do that, I would recommend it. I can't recommend it enough.
Yep.
A good editor is worth their weight in gold.
Yeah, yeah. The Gestalt Publishing usually has some sort of, I guess, appearance at cons, at least in recent years. Obviously, that's not happening now. Are there plans in the pipe that around doing like a digital con for Gestalt Publishing people or staff, I mean, or appearances at digital cons? What's that, or is that just too early to tell?
There was one digital con that we were going to do last year and then just had scheduling problems, which is an unfortunate thing that happens. I don't believe there's any plans for Gestalt to do a Gestalt-centric one.
Yeah.
I would imagine that, like, as I understand it, most of the Australian conventions are planning to go ahead in some form this year.
So I'd imagine it won't be such as it is.
Like, I believe Oz Comic Con is doing a pop-up con or something.
Okay, righto.
Which I think essentially just means local guests only.
Okay, no interstate people, no overseas people.
Yeah, none of those.
Yeah.
So as you say, such as it is, that will be the case for this year, and I would hope, touch wood, touch any kind of wood that you can get a hand on, that things would be back to normal for 2022.
What would you say to someone who's listened to this podcast or heard about Talguard? What would you say to them, and why should they check out Talguard Tome 1 and the upcoming release of Talguard Tome 2?
I would suggest that you go to GaryProudly.com and have a read. They are four-page stories. They're not very deep investments of time.
Yeah.
As I say to people at cons, you will find a story in this book that you like. They may not all be for you, but I find that's the case with any sort of anthology. If you read an anthology, you'll find one or two stories in it that really resonate with you. The other thing about Talguard as well is that each story is illustrated by a different Australian creator. So they're all written by me. They're all edited and lettered by Wolfgang, and they're all coloured by Justin Randall. So there's a certain feel to them all, especially provided by Justin's colouring. That means there's a cohesion and a consistency. But it's a really great book to see a wide range of incredible Australian artistic talent, ranging from seasoned pros who've been doing this for decades all the way to some people who I think this is their first published work.
Right. Yep. Excellent. And, I mean, myself, for one, I really enjoy what I've seen of Talgard. I've seen four stories out of what's going to appear in Tome 2. And I really like the sort of the contrast between the different, I guess, the artists involved. But at the same time, I sort of like the I guess, consistency or I guess you could call it symmetry in terms of with each story, I feel there's a different aspect of the Talgard main character that's you're sort of gradually peeling away at and digging into, which is interesting. It's made clear through your sort of writing. But then the other interesting part of it is sort of a new sort of element to the character that you're starting to chip away at is also being revealed through the artist as well, which I've found even more interesting. Like of the most recent two that's been released, I found the one involving, you know, the sort of the village cult that's happening. I found interesting that is the softer sort of line work of the artist kind of gave a little of the softer side of the character, if you know what I mean. And so for that, if that alone hasn't convinced someone to pick this up or at least go to your website and check it out before Gestalt release Tome 2, then I don't know what else will, Gary.
No, neither do I. Nicely put. Thank you.
You're doing great work, my friend. Great work indeed. So for those who have listened to this podcast, please check us out on Apple Podcasts. Give us a rating and review. It definitely helps out with the algorithm. Gary, where can everyone find you once again?
GaryProudley.com or GestaltComics.com would be the best places to find my work.
Very good. And for me, my name has been Anthony Pollock, and thank you very much, Gary, for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And that's a wrap, everyone. We'll see you next episode.